"The heads of three generals in my briefcase," reported one staff officer upon returning from a mission to the front. Lanrezac could not be disposed of so easily. Joffre believed the Fifth Army needed a more confident leader, yet to remove its commander in the midst of retreat might endanger morale. To an aide, he confessed that the problem had already given him two sleepless nights, the only occasion of the war known to have caused this grave disturbance. Meanwhile, the 61st and 62nd Reserve Divisions from Paris, who were supposed to join the new Sixth Army, had got lost. Their commander, General Ebener, had been looking for them all day, but nobody knew what had become of them. Fearing that the Sixth Army's detraining area was about to be overrun, Joffre, in a desperate effort to gain time for it to come into position, ordered the Fifth Army to turn and counterattack. This required an offensive in a westerly direction between Saint-Quentin and Guise. Colonel Alexandre, Joffre's liaison officer with the Fifth Army, conveyed the order verbally to Lanrezac's headquarters, then at Marle, some 25 miles east of Saint-Quentin. At the same time, in an effort to assuage the pique and invigorate the spirit of Sir John French, Joffre sent him a telegram expressing the gratitude of the French army for the brave assistance of their British comrades. Hardly was it dispatched when he learned the British had evacuated Saint-Quentin, uncovering Lanrezac's left just at the moment he was supposed to attack. According to another of Huguet's missives of doom, the BEF was beaten and incapable of serious effort, with three of its five divisions unable to take the field again until thoroughly rested and refitted, that is, for some days or even a few weeks. As Sir John French was reporting the same thing in almost the same words to Kitchener, Huguet cannot be blamed for reflecting the mood of the British chiefs, rather than that of the troops or the facts. On top of his message came one from Colonel Alexandre saying Lanrezac was balking at the order to attack. Although many of his officers responded with enthusiasm to the order, Lanrezac himself regarded it as almost insane, and said so. To face the Fifth Army was to invite attack by the enemy on its open right flank. He believed it was necessary to disengage fully and fall further back to Laon before a firm line could be established and a counterattack made with any chance of success. An attack now in the direction ordered by Joffre required him to turn a semi-disorganized army halfway around in a complicated maneuver, dangerous in view of his position and of the menace on his right. His chief of operations, Commandant Schneider, attempted to explain the difficulty to Colonel Alexandre, who expressed astonishment. "What?" said he. "Why, what could be simpler? You are facing north. We ask you to face west, to attack from Saint-Quentin." With a gesture of his hand, five fingers spread out to represent the five corps, he described a right-angle turn in the air. "Don't talk nonsense, mon colonel," burst out Schneider, exasperated. "Well, if you don't want to do anything," Colonel Alexandre said, finishing with a contemptuous shrug, which caused Lanrezac, who was present, to lose his temper and explain at great length and no great tact his opinion of GQG's strategy. By now, his confidence in Joffre and GQG was on a par with theirs in him. Having on one wing an independent foreign general who refused to act jointly, and on the other an unprotected flank, Foch's detachment did not start forming until 2 days later, August 29, and being now called upon for a counter-offensive, Lanrezac was under severe stress. His was not a temperament that rose to it. Given a task so fateful for France, and lacking any confidence in Joffre's judgment, he relieved his feelings in the bad temper and caustic abuse for which he had been known even in peacetime. He expounded upon his lack of respect for Joffre, whom he called a sapper, a mere engineer. "I found General Lanrezac surrounded by a number of officers," reported a staff officer from one of the corps who came to see him. "He seemed to be extremely displeased and expressed himself in violent language. He did not mince words in his criticism of GQG and our allies. He was much irritated against the former and the British. The gist of what he was saying was that all he required was to be left alone, that he would retire as far as was necessary, that he would choose his own time, and then he would boot the enemy back where he came from." In Lanrezac's own words, I suffered an anxiety so awful I did not even try to dissimulate from the staff. To show anxiety before subordinates was bad enough. To compound the sin by public criticism of GQG and the Generalissimo numbered Lanrezac's days of command. Early next morning, August 28, Joffre himself appeared at Marle, where he found Lanrezac haggard, bloodshot, and objecting with nervous gestures to the plan for a counteroffensive. When Lanrezac insisted again upon the risk of enemy attack from the right while his whole army was facing westward, Joffre suddenly fell into a violent fit of rage and shouted, "Do you wish to be relieved of your command? You must march without discussion. The fate of the campaign is in your hands." This spectacular outburst reverberated as far as Paris, taking on added thunder as it travelled, so that by the time it reached President Poincaré's diary next day, it was recorded as Joffre's threat to have Lanrezac shot if he hesitated or disobeyed orders to attack. Convinced of the error of the plan, Lanrezac refused to move without a written order. Having calmed down, Joffre assented and signed an order drawn up at his dictation by Lanrezac's chief of staff. In Joffre's opinion, a commander, knowing his orders and his duty, could have no further cause for disquiet. And he might have said to Lanrezac what he was one day to say to Pétain when giving him orders to hold Verdun under the heaviest bombardment in history. Eh bien, mon ami, maintenant vous êtes tranquille. Well, now, my friend, now you should feel easy. Something less than tranquil, Lanrezac accepted his task but insisted he could not be ready before next morning. All day, while the Fifth Army was being turned sideways in a complicated and intricate transfer of corps across each other's fronts, GQG was constantly calling, telling them to hurry, until Lanrezac, in a fury, ordered his staff not to answer the telephone. On the same day, the British chiefs were hurrying the BEF southward with such urgency that the soldiers were deprived of the rest they needed far more than they needed distance from the enemy. On that day, August 28, a day when von Kluck's columns gave them no trouble, Sir John French and Wilson were in such anxiety to hasten the retreat that they ordered transport wagons to throw overboard all ammunition and other impediments not absolutely required and carry men instead. Discarding ammunition meant abandoning further battle. As the BEF was not fighting on British soil, its commander was prepared to pull his forces out of the line regardless of the effective withdrawal upon his ally. The French army had lost the opening battle and was in a serious, even desperate situation in which every division counted to prevent defeat. But it was neither broken through nor enveloped by the enemy. It was fighting hard, and Joffre was exhibiting every intention of fighting further. Nevertheless, Sir John French, succumbing to the belief that the danger was mortal, had determined that the BEF must be preserved from being involved in a French defeat. Field commanders did not share the pessimism of headquarters. Receiving an order that virtually rejected any further idea of fighting, they were dismayed. Haig's chief of staff, General Gough, tore it up in anger. Smith Dorrien, who regarded his situation as excellent, with the enemy only in small parties and those keeping at a respectful distance, countermanded the order to his own 3rd and 5th Divisions. His message reached General Snow of the 4th Division too late. Having received a direct order addressed to Snowball from Henry to load up your lame ducks and hustle along, he had already carried it out, with very damping effect on the troops, who were made to think they must be in an extremity of danger, and who lost their spare clothing and boots as well. In dust, heat, and discouragement and fatigue beyond telling, the British retreat continued. Trailing through Saint-Quentin, the tired remnants of two battalions gave up, piled up their arms in the railroad station, sat down in the Place de la Gare, and refused to go farther. They told Major Bridges, whose cavalry had orders to hold off the Germans until Saint-Quentin was clear of troops, that their commanding officers had given the mayor a written promise to surrender in order to save the town further bombardment. Not caring to confront the battalion colonels, whom he knew and who were senior to him, Bridges wished desperately for a band to rouse the 200 or 300 dispirited men lying about in the square. Why not? There was a toy shop handy which provided my trumpeter and myself with a tin whistle and a drum, and we marched round and round the fountain where the men were lying like the dead, playing the British Grenadiers and Tipperary and beating the drum like mad. The men sat up, began to laugh, then cheer, then one by one stood up, fell in, and eventually we moved off slowly into the night to the music of our improvised band, now reinforced with a couple of mouth organs. Uncheered by fife or drum, Sir John French, seeing only his own sector, was convinced that the Kaiser, in his rancour and hate, has really risked weakness in other parts of the field in order to concentrate an overwhelming force to destroy us. He demanded that Kitchener send him the 6th Division, and when Kitchener said it could not be spared until its place in England was taken by troops from India, he considered this refusal most disappointing and injurious. In fact, for one moment after the shock of Mons, Kitchener had considered using the 6th Division for a landing on the German flank in Belgium. The old idea, long advocated by Fischer and Escher, of using the BEF independently in Belgium instead of as an appendix to the French line, never ceased to haunt the British. Now it was tried, as it was to be again 2 months later at Antwerp, in miniature and in vain. Instead of the 6th Division, 3 battalions of Royal Marines landed at Ostend on August 27 and 28 in an effort to draw off von Kluck's forces. They were joined by 6,000 Belgians, who had followed the French retreat after the fall of Namur, and were now sent up to Ostend by sea in British ships, but who proved to be in no condition to fight. By this time, the retreat in France, having swept the front too far away, the operation had lost its meaning, and the Marines were re-embarked on August 31. Before that happened, Sir John French, on August 28, evacuated his forward base at Amiens, which was now menaced by von Kluck's westward sweep, and on the following day gave orders for moving the main British base back from Le Havre to Saint-Nazaire, below the Normandy Peninsula. In the same spirit as the order jettisoning ammunition, the move reflected the single urgent desire that now possessed him to leave France. Partly sharing it, partly ashamed to share it, Henry Wilson, as described by a fellow officer, walked slowly up and down the room with that comical, whimsical expression on his face habitual to him, clapping his hands softly together to keep time, as he chanted in a low tone, "We shall never get there. We shall never get there." As he passed me, I said, "Where are we?" And he chanted on, "To the sea, to the sea, to the sea." Chapter 20. The Front is Paris. The grand boulevards were empty, shop fronts were shuttered, buses, trams, cars and horse cabs had disappeared. In their place, flocks of sheep were herded across the Place de la Concorde, on their way to the Gare de l'Est for shipment to the front. Unmarred by traffic, squares and vistas revealed their purity of design. Most newspapers having ceased publication, the kiosks were hung meagerly with the single-page issues of the survivors. All the tourists were gone, the Ritz was uninhabited, the Meurice a hospital. For one August in its history, Paris was French and silent. The sun shone, fountains sparkled in the rond-point, trees were green, the quiet Seine flowed by unchanging, brilliant clusters of Allied flags enhanced the pale grey beauty of the world's most beautiful city. In the vast warren of the Invalides, Gallieni grappled with obstructionism and the hesitancy of officials to take the radical measures necessary to make the words "entrenched camp" a reality. He envisaged the camp as a base of operations, not a Troy holed up for siege. From the experience of Liège and Namur, he knew that Paris could not withstand shelling by the new heavy siege guns of the enemy, but his plan was not to wait passively to be invested, but to give battle, with the army he did not yet have, beyond the outer ring of fortifications. Study of the Balkan and Manchurian wars had convinced him that a system of deep and narrow trenches, protected by earth mounds and logs, flanked by barbed wire and wolf pits, wide-mouthed holes fitted at the bottom with up-pointed stakes, and manned by trained and determined troops armed with machine guns, would be virtually impregnable. These were what he was trying to construct in the stretches between the artillery posts, although he still did not have the army to man them. Every day, sometimes two and three times a day, with increasing desperation, he telephoned GQG demanding the three active corps. He wrote to Joffre, sent emissaries, hammered at the Ministry of War and the President, repeatedly warned them Paris was unprepared. By August 29, he had received under his orders so far one naval brigade, whose appearance marching through the streets in white with high-pitched pipe delighted the populace, if not Gallieni. He conceived of the work to be done as tripartite: military defence, moral defence, and provisioning. To accomplish each of these tasks, it was necessary to be frank with the public. As much as he despised politicians, Gallieni respected the people of Paris, who he considered could be counted on to behave sensibly in the face of danger. He believed Poincaré and Viviani did not want to tell the country the truth, and suspected them of preparing a mummery to deceive the people. His efforts to obtain authority for demolition of buildings obstructing the fort's line of fire were hampered by official reluctance to alarm the population. Each destruction of property required a document signed by both the mayor of the arrondissement and the chief of engineers, fixing the value of indemnity to the proprietor, a process that was a source of endless harassment and delay. Each decision was enmeshed in a further Byzantine argument by those who contended that Paris, as the seat of government, could not be a fortified camp to be defended militarily. The issue, as General Hirschhaus disgustedly remarked, offered a magnificent field of controversy, and he feared the proponents of an open city would soon succeed in proving the post of military governor itself illegal. "You cannot convince the jurists without a text," he said. Gallieni provided one. On August 28, the zone of the armies was extended to include Paris and the country on both sides down to the Seine, with the result that the municipal government of Paris was brought under the authority of the military governor. At 10 a.m., Gallieni assembled his military and civil cabinets in a council of defence, which was held with everyone standing up and was over by 10:15. Members were asked not to discuss whether Paris should be defended, but simply to attest that the presence of the enemy required the institution of a state of defence. Documents providing the legal basis were already drawn up and lying on the table. Gallieni invited each person to sign his name and immediately declared the council adjourned. It was the first and last he held. Ruthlessly, he pursued work on the defences, sparing no time or pity on demurrers or the irresolute, on weakness or ineptitude. Like Joffre, he liquidated incompetence, on his first day of office dismissing a general of engineers and another general 2 days later. All inhabitants of the suburbs, even the oldest and least capable, were impressed for labour with pick and shovel. An order for 10,000 spades and pickaxes to be collected within 24 hours was issued. By evening, all had been delivered. When on the same occasion Gallieni ordered 10,000 bowie knives for use as tools, his purveyor protested it was impossible because their purchase was illegal. "All the more reason," replied Gallieni, looking at him sharply over his pince-nez, and the knives were obtained. On August 29, an area around Paris within a radius of about 20 miles, reaching to Melun on the south and Dammartin and Pontoise on the north, was brought under Gallieni's authority. Preparations were made for dynamiting bridges in the area. For those classified as works of art and part of the national heritage, a system of special guards was arranged to ensure that they were not destroyed until the last extremity. All entries to the city, even the sewers, were barricaded. Bakers, butchers, market gardeners were organized, and cattle brought in to graze in the Bois de Boulogne. To hasten the assembly of stocks of ammunition, Gallieni requisitioned transport by all means available, including the taxis of Paris, so soon to become immortal. Assigned to the artillery staff of the entrenched camp was one already encased in history, former captain, now major, Alfred Dreyfus, returned to active service at 55. At the front, the 1st and 2nd armies in Lorraine, under the terrible pressure of Ruprecht's guns, still held fiercely and tenaciously to the line of the Moselle. Their line wavered and bulged, in some places even was pierced by German wedges. Tightly contained by French counterattacks on their flanks, these could not be widened to major openings. The battle went on, with Ruprecht's armies probing for the weakest place, and Dubai and Castelnau, losing troops to Joffre's demands for the west, uncertain how long they could hold on or whether they could hold. In the villages taken by the Germans, the events of Belgium were reenacted. In Nomeny, on the outskirts of Nancy, "Citizens fired on our troops," declared the German governor of Metz in a bulletin posted on the walls. "I have therefore ordered as a punishment that the village shall be burned to the ground. Nomeny is thus by now destroyed." On Castelnau's left, where the front turned to the west, Ruffet's Third Army, unbalanced by the removal of Manoury's divisions, was falling back behind the Meuse below Verdun. Next to it, the Fourth Army, which had rested in position on August 28 to prove the retreat was strategic and not a rout, was ordered, to the disgust of General de Langle, to resume its retreat on August 29. Further to the left, where the pressure against the French line was the greatest, General Lanrezac's Fifth Army was completing the turning manoeuvre preparatory for the counterattack on Saint-Quentin, which Joffre had imposed upon its unwilling commander. At the extreme end of the line, Manoury's Sixth Army was coming into position. Between Manoury and Lanrezac, the BEF was being pulled out by Sir John French, despite his knowledge of the battle that would be fought on the morrow. Almost the process was interrupted by a much-needed deed of Anglo-French cooperation when Haig sent word to Lanrezac that his troops were perfectly ready to attack, and he wished to enter into direct communication and act in concert with the Fifth Army in its planned action at Saint-Quentin. One of Lanrezac's staff immediately hastened to meet him, and found Haig standing picturesquely on a little hill, while an orderly held his horse beside a lance with a fluttering white cross pennon planted in the ground. Haig said his air reconnaissance reported the enemy moving southwest of Saint-Quentin, exposing his flank as he advances. "Go quickly to your general and give him this information. Let him act. I am anxious to cooperate with him in this attack." The offer, conveyed to Lanrezac, gave him lively satisfaction and moved him to say some nice things concerning Sir Douglas Haig. Arrangements for joint action in the morning were confirmed, subject only to approval by the British commander-in-chief. At 2 a.m., word came from GHQ that Sir John French refused permission on the ground that the troops were very tired and must have at least one day's rest, a requirement which, however true of the Second Corps, was not true of the First Corps, whose commander himself had reported them fit and ready. Lanrezac exploded with wrath. "C'est une felonie! It's betrayal!" he shouted, and added what a listener described as terrible, unpardonable things about Sir John French and the British Army. Nevertheless, next morning, sandwiched between von Bülow, who was moving down against him, and Joffre, who came up to superintend the offensive, Lanrezac had no choice but to attack. From papers found on a captured French officer, Bülow had learned of the coming attack and was not taken off guard. Doubting Lanrezac's mood, Joffre arrived early in the morning at Lens, now Lanrezac's headquarters, to lend him sang-froid out of his own bottomless supply. Lens is built on a high mesa, from which the view extends over miles of rolling fields that rise and dip like the swells of a green ocean. 20 miles to the north, in a great semicircle, the Fifth Army was drawn up facing northwest toward Guise and Saint-Quentin. From the tower of the cathedral at the highest point of the town, the carved stone heads of cows instead of gargoyles gaze in bovine serenity over the landscape. Beneath them, in the same silent calm, Joffre sat watching Lanrezac dictate orders and conduct the battle. He stayed for 3 hours without saying a word, until, satisfied that Lanrezac was displaying authority and method, he felt able to leave for a good lunch at the station restaurant before proceeding with his racing chauffeur on his next errand. This was to find Sir John French, who he suspected had his eyes on the Channel coast and might be getting out of our line of battle for a long time. The place he held in the line between Lanrezac's army and the gathering Sixth Army of Manoury was now crucial, and yet outside Joffre's power to control. He could not give orders to Field Marshal French, as he did to Lanrezac, or force him to fight by sitting behind him in silent surveillance. If, however, he could persuade the British to stand still, he hoped to stabilize a front on the Aisne along the line Amiens-Reims-Verdun and resume the offensive from there. British headquarters having taken another backward step the day before, Sir John was now established at Compiègne, which was 40 miles, or, for tired armies, about 3 days' march from Paris. While its neighbour, the French Fifth Army, was fighting all during this day at Guise, lifting enemy pressure, the British Army rested. Having retreated without pursuit the day before, it now, after 8 hot days of marching, digging trenches and fighting engagements great and small, at last came to a halt. The Second Corps made a short march during the evening hours to bring it across the Oise, but the First Corps enjoyed a full day's rest in the forest of Saint-Gobain, only 5 miles from where the left wing of Lanrezac's army, which had been marching and fighting for 14 days and was no less tired, was engaged in major battle. When Joffre reached Compiègne, he pleaded with the British commander to stick fast until the offensive could be resumed at a favourable moment. His arguments seemed to produce no effect. He distinctly saw Murray tugging at the Field Marshal's tunic as if to prevent him from yielding to persuasion. It was a supererogatory effort, for Sir John French kept saying, "No, no," to Joffre, and insisting that in view of his losses his army was in no condition to fight and must have 2 days to rest and refit. Joffre could not dismiss him on the spot as he would have a French general. He could not even throw a fit of temper to gain his ends, as he had with Lanrezac at Marle. With the British backing away from the space between Lanrezac and Manoury, neither of their armies could hold along the present line, and all hope of carrying out General Order No. 2 must be abandoned. Joffre departed, by his own confession, in very bad humour. Sir John French's intentions were even more drastic than he admitted to Joffre. Without regard for an ally fighting on the threshold of defeat, he now told his Inspector of Communications, Major General Robb, to plan for a definite and prolonged retreat due south, passing Paris to the east and west. Even Kitchener's instructions could not be blamed for this. Conceived in deep disapproval of Henry Wilson's commitment to Plan 17, they were designed to restrain a too aggressive Sir John and a too Francophile Wilson from risking the British army in some French-sponsored scheme of offensive à outrance that could lead to annihilation or capture. They were never intended to suggest such a degree of caution as would lead to actual desertion. But the sweat that comes from fear cannot be controlled, and Sir John was now gripped by fear of losing his army, and with it his name and reputation. His troops were not, as he pretended, a broken army unfit for further effort. By their own account, they were in no mood to give up. Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Morris of the 3rd Division Staff said that despite exhaustion, sore feet, and lack of time for cooked meals, the restorative effect of a hot meal, a good night's rest and a bath is little short of marvellous. These were what our army chiefly needed to enable it to take the field again. Captain Ernest Hamilton of the 11th Hussars said that after its day of rest on August 29, the BEF was now in perfect trim to turn and fight at any moment. General MacCready, Adjutant General in the BEF, said all they needed was rest and food to make them ready and eager to show the Germans what they could do. Nevertheless, Sir John French next day sent Joffre a definitive notice that the British Army would not be in condition to take its place in the line for another 10 days. Had he asked for 10 days' time out when fighting with his back to London, he would not have survived in command. As it was, Sir John French remained commander-in-chief for another year and a half. That afternoon, on edge to get his men on the move and away from the vicinity of the enemy, he was anxious to have Lanrezac break off his battle and resume the retreat with him shoulder to shoulder, less out of concern for covering Lanrezac's flank than to protect his own. In an effort to obtain an order for the Fifth Army to do this, Henry Wilson called GQG, and finding that Joffre had not returned, spoke to General Berthelot, who refused to assume authority, but arranged to have Wilson intercept Joffre at the Hôtel Lion d'Or in Reims at 7:30 that evening. At mealtime, Joffre's whereabouts were always known. Wilson, when he found him, argued in vain. All Joffre would say was, "Lanrezac must see it out to the end," without specifying what end he had in mind. When Wilson returned with this news, Sir John decided not to wait and gave orders for the BEF to resume the retreat next day. Meanwhile, Lanrezac's advance on Saint-Quentin was meeting difficulties. A regiment of the 18th Corps, under orders to take a village down the road, advanced under shrapnel falling like hail. "Shells gutted the road and tore branches from the trees in huge pieces," wrote a sergeant who survived. "It was stupid to lie down. One might as well keep moving. Here and there men lay flat on their stomachs or on their backs. They were dead. One of them, under an apple tree, had all of his face missing. Blood drowned his head. On the right, drums sounded the bayonet charge, followed by the trumpet. Our line advanced, marked by the sparkle of the bayonet slanted against a blue sky. The rhythm of the drums quickened. 'Forward!' All the men cried forward. It was a superb moment. An electric shiver went through my scalp and contracted the roots of my hair. The drums beat in a rage. The hot wind carried the notes of the trumpet. The men shouted. They were transported. Suddenly we were stopped. To charge a village 900 yards away against a solid defense was folly. The order came, 'Lie down. Take cover.' The attack on Saint-Quentin was thrown back, and as Lanrezac had anticipated, heavy enemy pressure began to bear down upon his right. Bülow was attacking with all his forces, instead of allowing the French to move forward against him, so that they might be taken in the rear by the armies of Kluck and Hausen. Believing that the action was no more than the death throes of a broken army, Bülow felt confident of the outcome. In one sector, the French were driven back across the Oise, and a panic developed when the bridges and narrow roads leading off them became jammed. Displaying the greatest quickness and comprehension, in the words of his least sympathetic observer, Lanrezac quickly ordered abandonment of the action at Saint-Quentin and a new concentration of effort to redeem the situation on the right at Guise. Franchet d'Esperey, commander of the First Corps, the eager, sturdy little general, burned by the sons of Tonkin and Morocco, whom Poincaré called a stranger to depression, was ordered to rally the 3rd and 10th Corps on his left and right. With the aid of officers riding up and down the front on horseback and bands playing once again the quick, bright chords of the Sambrais Meuse, he reformed the line by 5:30 p.m. Preceded by a well-prepared artillery action, the French moved forward once more to the attack. The bridge at Guise was piled high with ramparts of enemy dead. On the far side, resistance was desultory. The French could feel it weakening. "The Germans were running away," wrote an observer, "and the French, frantic with joy at the new and longed-for sensation, were carried forward in a splendid, victorious wave." At the day's end, when the sergeant who had participated in the attack on Saint-Quentin returned to the village from which he had started that morning, he was met by a friend who had all the news. He said it had been a great day. Our check didn't matter. The enemy was pushed back. We were the winners. The colonel was killed by a shell. He died while they were carrying him off. Commandant Terron was wounded in the chest. Captain Gilberti was wounded and would not live. Many of the men were dead or wounded. He repeated it had been a good day, because the regiment would sleep 2 nights in the same place. The retirement of the Guard Corps, the elite of Bülow's army, pulled back its neighbours and gave Lanrezac a tactical victory, at Guise if not at Saint-Quentin. But he was now alone and exposed, facing north, while his neighbours on both sides, the British and the Fourth Army, each a full day's march ahead of him, were continuing their retreat and further uncovering his flanks at every step. If the Fifth Army were to be saved, it must immediately break off battle and rejoin its partners. But Lanrezac could get no directive from Joffre, who was not at GQG, when Lanrezac telephoned. "Is the Fifth Army to delay in the region of Guise-Saint-Quentin at the risk of being captured?" Lanrezac asked General Belin, Joffre's deputy. "What do you mean, let your army be captured? That's absurd. You do not understand me. I am here at the express orders of the Commander-in-Chief. I cannot take it upon myself to withdraw to Long. It is for the Commander-in-Chief to give me the order to retire. Lanrezac was not going to take the blame this time, as at Charleroi. Refusing to assume authority, Belin said he would report the question to Joffre as soon as he returned. When Joffre did return, although he appeared still confident, still unruffled, his hopes had suffered a second crash, even graver than the debacle at the frontiers, because now the enemy was that much deeper into France. He had no way of knowing that Lanrezac's fight had inflicted a sharp check on Bülow's army, because the results did not yet show. He could only recognize that the Fifth Army was in truth left in a dangerous position, that the BEF was backing out, and he could no longer nourish any hope of holding our allies on the anticipated line of battle. The Sixth Army, while still in the process of forming, was under heavy attack from Kluck's two right-wing corps. The front he had hoped to hold was dissipated, more territory would have to be yielded, perhaps as far as the Marne, perhaps even to the Seine. During this period, the most tragic in all French history, as its chief investigator was to call it, Joffre did not panic like Sir John French, or waver like Moltke, or become momentarily unnerved like Haig or Ludendorff, or succumb to pessimism like Prittwitz. What went on behind that opaque exterior, he never showed. If he owed his composure to a failure of imagination, that was fortunate for France. Ordinary men, Clausewitz wrote, become depressed by a sense of danger and responsibility. If these conditions are to lend wings to strengthen the judgment, there must be present unusual greatness of soul. If danger did not strengthen Joffre's judgment in any way, it did call forth a certain strength of soul, or of character. When ruin was all around him, he maintained an even tenor, a stolid control. What Foch, who saw him on August 29, called a wonderful calm, which held the French army together in an hour when it most needed the cement of confidence. On one of these days, Colonel Alexandre, returning from a mission to the Fifth Army, excused his expression of gloom on the ground of the bad news I have to bring. "What?" answered Joffre. "Do you no longer believe in France? Go get some rest. You'll see. Everything will be all right." That night of August 29, at 10 p.m, he issued the order for Lanrezac to retire and blow up the bridges of the Oise behind him. General Damard was ordered to blow up the bridges over the Somme at Amiens and fall back along with Manoury's army. On the right, the Fourth Army was ordered to retire on Reims, and General de Langle, who demanded rest for his troops, was told that rest depended on the enemy. As his final bitter act of the night of August 29, Joffre ordered preparations made for leaving Vitry-le-François, that headquarters of broken hopes and lost illusions. GQG was to be moved back to Bar-sur-Aube on an eastern tributary of the Seine. The news spread among the staff, adding, as Joffre disapprovingly noted, to the general nervousness and anxiety. Through a staff failure, Joffre's order to the Fifth Army did not reach Lanrezac till early next morning, causing him a long night of unnecessary agony. Fortunately, von Bülow did not renew the combat, or, when Lanrezac withdrew, follow after. The results of the battle were as obscure to the Germans as to the French, and Bülow's impressions seem to have been curiously mixed, for he both reported it to OHL as a success, and at the same time sent a staff captain to von Kluck to say his army was exhausted by the Battle of Guise and unable to pursue. Ignorant of this, the French, Joffre as well as Lanrezac, were possessed by a single aim, to disengage the Fifth Army and bring it out of danger and into line with the other French armies before the Germans could outflank it on the left. Meanwhile, the threat to Paris of the oncoming German right wing was evident. Joffre telegraphed Gallieni to lay charges under the bridges of the Seine immediately to the west of Paris, and of the Marne immediately to the east, and to post platoons of engineers at each one to make sure that orders to blow the bridges would be carried out. Manoury's army, in falling back, would cover Paris and be the natural group to provide the army of three corps Gallieni was demanding. But to Joffre and GQG, Paris was still a geographical expression. To defend it for its own sake, and for that purpose put Manouri's army at Gallieni's disposal and under his orders, was not Joffre's intention. Paris, as he saw it, would stand all four with the result of the battle he intended to fight with the whole field army under his own command. To the men inside Paris, however, the fate of the capital was of more direct interest. The apparent result of the Battle of Saint-Quentin and Guise deepened a pall of dismay hanging over them. On the morning of the battle, Monsieur Touron, vice-president of the Senate and an industrial magnate of the north, rushed into Poincaré's office like a whirlwind, claiming that the government was being deceived by GQG and that our left had been turned and the Germans are at La Fère. Poincaré repeated the stout assurances of Joffre that the left would hold, and that as soon as the Sixth Army was ready, the offensive would be resumed. But in the back of his mind, he feared that Monsieur Touron might be right. Cryptic messages filtered in, indicating a great battle was in progress. Every hour he received contradictory reports. Late in the afternoon, Monsieur Touron burst in again, more excited than ever. He had just been talking over the telephone to Monsieur Céline, a fellow senator from the Aisne who owned a property near Saint-Quentin and who had been watching the battle from the roof of his house. Monsieur Céline had seen the French troops advancing and the puffs of smoke and the black shell bursts filling the sky, and then, as German reinforcements like an army of grey ants were brought up, had seen the French thrown back. The attack had not succeeded, the battle was lost, and Monsieur Touron departed, wailing. The second stage of the battle, at Guise, did not come under the eyes of the senator on the roof, and was even less clear to the government than to GQG. All that seemed clear was that Joffre's attempt to check the German right wing had failed, that Paris faced siege, and might again eat rats as it had 40 years before. The possibility of the fall of the capital, the question whether the government should leave, which had been lurking in ministerial minds since the Battle of the Frontiers, was now openly and urgently discussed. Colonel Penelon, liaison officer between GQG and the President, arrived early next morning, his usually smiling face for once sombre, and admitted the situation was intensely serious. Millerand, as Minister of War, at once advised departure to avoid being cut off from the rest of the country. Gallieni, hastily summoned for his opinion, advised telephoning Joffre. Joffre acknowledged the situation was not good. The Fifth Army had fought well, but had not accomplished his hopes. The English had not budged. The advance of the enemy could not be slowed, and Paris was seriously menaced. He advised the government to leave, so as not, by remaining, to be the means of drawing the enemy upon the capital. Joffre knew well enough that the German objective was the French armies, not the government. But as the battlefield neared Paris, the presence of the government in the zone of the armies would tend to blur the lines of authority. Its withdrawal would remove a source of interference and leave GQG with enhanced power. When Gallieni, on the telephone, tried to convince him of the necessity of defending Paris as the material and moral hub of the war effort, and again demanded an army to attack the enemy in the field before the city could be invested, he somewhat vaguely promised to send him 3 corps, though not at full strength, and largely made up of reserve divisions. He gave Gallieni the impression that he considered Paris expendable and was still unwilling to deplete his forces for its sake. Then the President of the Republic, appearing preoccupied and even dispirited, although as always cold and reserved, asked Gallieni how long Paris could hold out and whether the government should leave. "Paris cannot hold out, and you should make ready to leave as soon as possible," Gallieni replied. Desiring no less than Joffre to unsaddle himself of the government, he found the advice painless. Poincaré asked him to return later to explain his views to the cabinet, which in the meantime assembled and passionately argued the question that a bare 10 days ago, when the French offensive was launched, would have seemed unthinkable. Poincaré, Ribaud, and the 2 socialists Guede and Sombart were for staying, or at least awaiting the outcome of the approaching battle. The moral effect of departure, they contended, could produce despair, even revolution. Millerand insisted upon departure. He said a company of Uhlans might penetrate below Paris and cut the railroads to the south, and the government could not take the risk of being shut up inside the capital as in 1870. This time France was fighting as part of an alliance, and it was the government's duty to remain in contact with her allies in the outside world, as well as with the rest of France. Dumergue made a deep impression when he said, "It takes more courage to appear a coward and risk popular disfavor than to risk being killed." Whether the emergency required reconvening Parliament, as was demanded in excited visits by the presidents of the two chambers, provided a subject for further heated dispute. Fretting with impatience to return to his duties, Gallieni was kept waiting outside for an hour while the ministers argued. Finally called in, he told them bluntly they were no longer safe in the capital. His stern and soldierly appearance and manner, and the clarity and force with which he expressed himself, made a profound effect. Explaining that without an army to fight outside the perimeter, he could not ward off assault by the enemy's siege artillery, he warned that Paris was not in a state of defence, and cannot be put in one. It would be an illusion to believe that the entrenched camp could offer a serious resistance if the enemy should appear in the next few days before our line of exterior forts. The formation of an army of four, or at least three corps, to fight under his orders outside the city as the extreme left wing of the French line was indispensable. The delay in preparing the defences, before his appointment as governor, he charged to influential groups who wanted Paris declared an open city to save it from destruction. They had been encouraged by GQG. "That's right," Millerand interrupted. "It is the opinion of GQG that Paris should not be defended." Ged, the socialist, speaking his first words as minister after a lifetime of opposition, excitedly broke in. "You want to open the gates to the enemy so Paris won't be pillaged, but on the day the Germans march through our streets there will be a shot fired from every window in the working-class quarters, and then I will tell you what will happen. Paris will be burned." After hectic debate, it was agreed that Paris must be defended and Joffre required to conform, if necessary, under pain of dismissal. Gallieni argued against any rash removal of the commander-in-chief at this stage. As to whether the government should go or stay, the cabinet remained completely at odds. Leaving the ministers, overcome with emotion and indecision, and as they seemed to him incapable of coming to a firm resolve, Gallieni returned to the Invalides, making his way through the crowds of anxious citizens besieging its doors for permits to leave the city, to take their cars, to close essential businesses, and a thousand other reasons. The buzz of anxiety was louder than usual. That afternoon, for the first time, a German Taube bombed Paris. Besides three bombs on the Quai de Valmy, which killed two persons and injured others, it dropped leaflets telling Parisians that the Germans were at their gates, as in 1870, and "there is nothing you can do but surrender." Daily thereafter, one or more enemy planes returned regularly at 6 p.m., dropped two or three bombs, and killed an occasional passerby, in an effort, presumably, to frighten the population. The fearful went south. For those who remained in Paris during this period, when no one knew if the next day might not bring the spiked helmets marching in, the flights of the Taube, always at the aperitif hour, provided excitement to compensate for the government's prohibition of absinthe. That night of its first visit, Paris was blacked out for the first time. "The only little gleam of light to pierce the general gloom," Poincaré wrote in his diary, "was in the east, where, according to a telegram from the French military attaché, the Russian armies were developing their offensive toward Berlin. In fact, they were being cut down and surrounded at Tannenberg, and on that night, General Samsonov committed suicide in the forest." Joffre heard a more accurate version when a German radio message, intercepted at Belfort, told of the destruction of three Russian corps, the capture of two corps commanders, and 70,000 other prisoners, and announced, "The Russian Second Army no longer exists." This terrible news, coming when French hopes were already sinking, might have dispirited even Joffre, except that it was followed by other news which showed the Russian sacrifice had not been in vain. Intelligence reports revealed the transfer of at least 2 German corps from the Western Front to the East, and were confirmed next day by reports of 32 troop trains passing eastward through Berlin. This was Joffre's gleam of light, this the aid for which all France's pressure on Russia had been brought to bear. Even so, it hardly counterbalanced the projected loss of the British, whose commander's refusal to remain in contact with the enemy opened the way to envelopment of the Fifth Army. The Fifth was also in danger of being outflanked on its right through the space thinly filled by the Foch detachment. Wherever a weak sector needed reinforcement, another sector had to be dangerously depleted. On this same day, August 30, Joffre visited the front of the 3rd and 4th Armies to look for forces he could assign to Foch. On the road he passed the retreating columns who had fought in the Ardennes and on the heights of the Meuse. Red trousers had faded to the colour of pale brick, coats were ragged and torn, shoes caked with mud, eyes cavernous in faces dulled by exhaustion and dark with many days' growth of beard. 20 days' campaigning seemed to have aged the soldiers as many years. They walked heavily as if ready to drop at every step. Emaciated horses, with bones sticking out and with bleeding harness sores, sometimes dropped in the shafts, were hurriedly unharnessed by the artillerymen and dragged off to the side of the road so as not to obstruct the way. Guns looked old and blistered, with barely a few patches of their once new grey paint showing through the mud and dirt. In contrast, other units, still vigorous, had become confident veterans in the 20 days, proud of their fighting skills and eager to halt the retreat. The ultimate compliment was earned by the 42nd Division of Ruffey's army, which, after holding the rearguard and successfully disengaging, was told by its corps commander, General Sarai, "You have given proof of cran." When Joffre ordered this division transferred to Foch, General Ruffey protested violently on the ground of an anticipated attack. Unlike General de Langle of the 4th Army, whom Joffre had just found calm, confident, and perfectly master of himself, the one essential duty of a commander in Joffre's eyes, Ruffey appeared nervous, excitable, and imaginative to an excessive degree. As Colonel Tanon, his chief of operations, said, "He was very clever and full of 1,000 ideas, of which one was magnificent, but the question was, which?" Like the deputies in Paris, Joffre needed a scapegoat for the failure of the offensive, and Ruffey's conduct decided the selection. He was removed that day from command of the 3rd Army and replaced by General Sarai. Invited to lunch next day with Joffre, Ruffey blamed his defeat in the Ardennes on the last-minute removal of the 2 reserve divisions that Joffre had transferred to the Army of Lorraine. If he'd had those 40,000 fresh men and the 7th Cavalry Division, Ruffey said, "He could have rolled up the enemy's left, and what a success for our arms we might have won." In one of his terse and mysterious remarks, Joffre replied, "Chut, il ne faut pas le dire." His tone of voice has been lost, and it will never be known whether he meant, "You're wrong, you must not say that," or, "You're right, but we must not admit it." On that Sunday, August 30, the day of Tannenberg, the day the French government was warned to leave Paris, England received a shock, since known as the Amiens dispatch. Headed with initial exaggeration, "Fiercest fight in history," it appeared with awful impact in a special Sunday edition of The Times, on the front page, where ordinarily discreet columns of advertising screened readers from the news. Subheads proclaimed, "Heavy losses of British troops, Mons and Cambrai, fight against severe odds, need for reinforcements." This last phrase was the key. Although the dispatch was to arouse an official storm, provoke a furious debate in Parliament, and earn a scolding from the Prime Minister as a regrettable exception to the patriotic reticence of the press as a whole, it was in fact published with an official purpose. Instantly seeing its qualities as recruiting propaganda, the censor, F.E. Smith, later Lord Birkenhead, passed it and urged it upon the Times, which published it as a patriotic duty, with an appended notice as to the extreme gravity of the task before us. It was written by a correspondent, Arthur Moore, who had arrived at the front in the midst of the retreat from Le Cateau and the hectic despair at GHQ. He wrote of a retreating and a broken army after the series of engagements, which may be called the action of Mons, the French retreat on the flank of the immediate, relentless, unresting German pursuit and its irresistible vehemence, of British regiments grievously injured, though with no failure in discipline, no panic, and no throwing up the sponge. In spite of everything, the men were still steady and cheerful, but forced backwards, ever backwards. He told of very great losses, of bits of broken regiments, and of some divisions having lost nearly all their officers. Evidently infected with the mood of GHQ, he wrote rather wildly of the German right wing, so great was their estimated superiority in numbers that they could no more be stopped than the waves of the sea. Britain, he concluded, must face the fact that the first great German effort has succeeded, and the investment of Paris cannot be banished from the field of possibility. When, in summarizing the need for reinforcements, he spoke of the BEF which bore the weight of the blow, he laid the foundations of a myth. It was as if the French army had been an adjunct somewhere in the offing. In fact, the BEF was never at any time in the first month in contact with more than three German corps out of a total of over 30. But the idea that it bore the weight of the blow was perpetuated in all subsequent British accounts of Mons and of the glorious retreat. It succeeded in planting in the British mind the conviction that the BEF, in the gallant and terrible days of its first month of battle, saved France, saved Europe, saved Western civilization, or as one British writer unbashfully put it, Mons, in that single word will be summed up the liberation of the world. Alone among the belligerents, Britain had gone to war with no prearranged framework of national effort, no mobilization orders in every pocket. Except for the regular army, all was improvisation, and during the first weeks, before the Amiens dispatch, almost a holiday mood. Up to then, the truth of the German advance was concealed by, to use Mr. Asquith's exquisite phrase, patriotic reticence. The fighting had been presented to the British public, as to the French, as a series of German defeats, in which the enemy unaccountably moved from Belgium to France and appeared each day on the map at places farther forward. All over England on August 30, as the Times was read at Sunday breakfast tables, people were aghast. It was as if, thought Mr. Brickling, David had flung his pebble and missed. In the sudden and dreadful realization that the enemy was winning the war, people searching for hope seized upon a tale that had cropped up within the last few days and turned it into a national hallucination. On August 27, a 17-hour delay in the Liverpool-London railway service inspired the rumour that the trouble was due to the transport of Russian troops who were said to have landed in Scotland on their way to reinforce the Western Front. From Archangel, they were supposed to have crossed the Arctic Sea to Norway, thence come by ordinary steamer to Aberdeen, and from there were being carried by special troop trains to Channel ports. Anyone whose train was held up thereafter knowingly attributed the delay to the Russians. In the gloom following the Amiens dispatch, with its talk of German numbers like the waves of the sea, and its cry for men, men and more men, thoughts turned unconsciously toward Russia's limitless manpower, and the phantoms seen in Scotland took on body, gathering corroborative detail as the story spread. They stamped snow off their boots on station platforms in August. A railway porter of Edinburgh was known who had swept up the snow. Strange uniforms were glimpsed in passing troop trains. They were reported variously to be going via Harwich to save Antwerp or via Dover to save Paris. 10,000 were seen after midnight in London, marching along the embankment on their way to Victoria Station. The naval battle of Heligoland was explained by the wise as a diversion to cover the transport of the Russians to Belgium. The most reliable people had seen them, or knew friends who had. An Oxford professor knew a colleague who had been summoned to interpret for them. A Scottish army officer in Edinburgh saw them in long, gaily coloured coats and big fur caps, carrying bows and arrows instead of rifles, and with their own horses, just like Scottish ponies, only bonier. a description that exactly fitted the Cossacks of 100 years ago, as they appeared in early Victorian mezzo tints. A resident of Aberdeen, Sir Stuart Coates, wrote to his brother-in-law in America that 125,000 Cossacks had marched across his estate in Perthshire. An English army officer assured friends that 70,000 Russians had passed through England to the Western Front in utmost secrecy. At first said to be 500,